Vishnu Pad, Padmahamsa Bhavraj Gatara Satir, Satashi Shimna's Divine Grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. And under the Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namachari Sarai Das Thakur Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Samaved Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda. All glorious to some of the devotees, all glorious to some of the devotees, all glorious to some of the devotees, all glorious to Sri Guru and Sri Granga. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Basavagade, Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Dhaname, Namaste Sarasvadevam, Gauravani Bhacharni, Nirvishesha Shunni Vadi Paskachade Siddharani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 3. We're doing text 28 through 31 today. So, 28.
Yada karmasu kamyesu.
Bhaktir yashasi dehinam. Tada treta rajo vritir. Iti janihi buddhinam. Iti janihi buddhiman. Yada karmasukham yeshu. Bhaktir yashasi dehinam. Tada treta rajo vritir. Iti janihi buddhiman. Yada karmasu kam yeshu. Bhaktir yashasi dehinam. Tada treta rajo vritir. Iti janihi buddhiman. Yada, when, karmasu, in duties, kamyeshu, based on selfish desire, bhakti, devotion, yayashi, in honor, dehinam, of the embodied souls, tada, then, treta, in the age of treta, Rajavriti, predominated by activities in the mode of passion, Iti. Thus. Janihi.
Janihi.
You should understand.
Buddhiman.
O intelligent King Pariket. Translation. O most intelligent one, when the conditioned souls are devoted to their duties, but have ulterior motives and seek personal prestige, you should understand such a situation to be in the age of Treta, in which the functions of passion are prominent. So let me read the next few verses. Start with text 29. Yidalobhastvasantosho mano dhamdo tamatsara karmanam chapikam yanam dvaparam tarvajastama. When greed, dissatisfaction, false pride, hypocrisy, and envy become prominent, along with attraction for selfish activities, such a time is the age of Dwapara, dominated by the mixed modes of passion and ignorance. 30. Yada martya ritam tandra nidra himsa vishadhanam shoka moha bhayam dainyam sakalistam shasmrita. When there's a predominance of cheating, lying, sloth, sleepiness, violence, depression, lamentation, bewilderment, fear, and poverty, that age is Kali, the age of the mode of ignorance. Report, in Kali Yuga, people are almost exclusively devoted to gross materialism with hardly any affinity for self-realization. In text 31, Tasmat Shudra Prisho Martya Shudra Bhagya Mahasana Kamino Vitahinascha Svaranyascha Sriyosati. Because of the bad qualities of the age of Kali, human beings will become short-sighted, unfortunate, gluttonous, lustful, and poverty-stricken. The women, becoming unchaste, will freely wander from one man to the next. Report by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. In the age of Kali, certain pseudo-intellectuals seeking individual freedom support sexual promiscuity. In fact, identification of the self with the body and the pursuit of individual freedom in the body rather than in the soul are signs of the most dismal ignorance and slavery to lust. When women are unchaste, many children are born out of wedlock as products of lust. These children grow up in psychologically unfavorable circumstances and a neurotic, ignorant society arises. Symptoms of this are already manifested throughout the world. Om Jnana Tvarandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksun Vikamina Kasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Pancha Kalpa Trubhischa Kripa Sindhu Bhebacha Patitano Pavani Bhyo Vaishnavi Yuno Namaha. So that last verse and purport were quite interesting, but we're not going to discuss it today. I'll explain that. Do a little recap of the chapter here. First of all, in chapter 3, we've already heard a lot about Kali Yuga. But in chapter 3, the earth, Bhumi, begins to speak, and for the first few verses, talks about the degradation of Kali Yuga, and particularly how the leaders become increasingly irreligious. Then about text 17, Maharaj Pariket asks Shukadeva Goswami to describe the Yugas, to describe sort of the historical changes of the Yuga cycles. So then those are beginning to be described here. And first of all, they were described in terms of the breakdown of the four religious principles, right? We talked about how, you know, cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, and what? Cleanliness, they say? Which was also sometimes called charity, right? Anyway, the breakdown of the four religious principles was described, and now we're discussing how the changes of modes of nature which come about progressively through the four yugas affect the execution of Dharma. And specifically, the motivation by which people engage in religious activities is described and how that is progressively deteriorating from Satya Yuga through Kali Yuga. Now, the remaining 20 verses of the chapter basically go back to describing Kali Yuga. So we get very vivid descriptions of all of the difficulties and problems in Kali Yuga. So, actually, usually these verses are divided by our very illustrious and hardworking person who gives us all the verses and divides it up. according to the purport, so that there's at least one, you know, good purport to be able to speak on. But in reality, really, the verse yesterday and the next three are sort of together, you know, because they describe the symptoms of the four yugas, Satya through Kali, and then this verse 31 really goes on with the rest of the verses that are describing Kali Yuga. That's why I'm not going to really discuss this one, the last one, so much, because we are going to thoroughly talk about Kali Yuga and all of its faults over the next several days. So, and this, in fact, this topic comes back again in a few verses. So, I want to actually go back one verse to yesterday's verse, because that begins Satya Yuga, and then just read these four verses, which are really a set, describing the how the modes of nature influence religious principles through the yugas. So 27 was, when the mind, intelligence, and senses are solidly fixed in the mode of goodness, that time should be understood as Satya Yuga, the age of truth. People then take pleasure in knowledge and austerity. O most intelligent one, when the conditioned souls are devoted to their duties but have ulterior motives and seek personal prestige, you should understand such a situation to be the age of Treta, in which the functions of passion are prominent. And then 29, when greed, dissatisfaction, false pride, hypocrisy, and envy become prominent, along with attraction for selfish activities, such is the time of Dwapara, dominated by the mixed modes of passion ignorance. And 30, when there's a predominance of cheating, lying, sloth, sleepiness, violence, depression, lamentation, bewilderment, fear, and poverty, that age is Kali, the age of the mode of ignorance. So, the Srimad Bhagavatam is discussing the motivational structure of the performance of Dharma. It's actually a very interesting perspective that's being given here to us by the Bhagavatam, because we often just hear about the degradation of the ages and how the principles of religion are breaking down. But here is actually a discussion of Dharma and how the living entity approaches Dharma, how one is motivated, what one's goals are. So what we're hearing here is that the influence of the modes of nature changes the nature of that Dharma. In Satya Yuga, which of course the mode of goodness was prominent, there was, it says here, pleasure and knowledge and austerity. In other words, there was a pure adherence to Dharma, very prominent. In Treta Yuga, in the next yuga, which is dominated by the mode of passion, there's devotion to Dharma. So people are mostly dharmically acting, but there's some personal motivation, such as prestige, starts to creep in. And then Dwapara Yuga, which is dominated by passion and ignorance, there's a mix of both Dharma and Adharma. That wasn't absolutely clear in the translation, but Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that the line karmanam chapikam yaman means that there's an affinity for both Dharma and Adharma, are both there in Dwapara Yuga. In other words, there is some Dharma and some desire for it, but there's also all these other influences are starting to come in because of the modes of ignorance and passion. So in Kali Yuga, the mode of ignorance is prominent, and therefore there is a prevalence of Adharma. And this is described in the next 20 verses, how this Adharma is manifested in Kali Yuga. So, and now also remember, of course, in just a couple verses ago, verse 26 mentioned that there are exceptions. In other words, there are sub-ages, there's different propensities, even within the prominent activities, behaviors, and influences of the modes of nature within each age. So in other words, even in former ages, which were maybe been dominated by a mode of goodness, there may have been demons. And in the age of Kali, obviously we have now the golden age of Kali, which is a sub-age within Kali. So the higher modes are a little bit still there. We're not totally immersed in ignorance yet, though that seems to be coming from everything we're hearing from the Srimad Bhagavatam. So as I was reading this and thinking about it, realizing this is such an important theme in the Srimad Bhagavatam and what distinguishes Srimad Bhagavatam and the Vaishnava literatures from so many scriptures, so much philosophy of the world. Because the Bhagavatam is concerned not just what we do and how we act, whether we act religiously or not, but it's very, very concerned with motive, with our goals, with our desires, with the reasons by which we do what we do, isn't it? This is like embedded throughout the Bhagavatam. In other words, it's not a question of, well, you have to do this rule and this rule. It's a question of what is in your heart, right? What is your faith? What is your motivation? Why is it that we're acting and doing what we're doing? Which is a very elevated way of approaching life, a very elevated way of approaching spirituality and religion. So right from the very beginning, second verse of the Bhagavatam, we have our famous line, Dharma Krojito Kaitavo, right? And Prabhupada translates this, completely rejecting all religious activities which are materially motivated. So even though we're in the age of Kali, when everyone's materially motivated, everyone is adharmic, we're receiving the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is saying, this scripture is not about any material motivation. In fact, it completely rejects any religion, any presentation of philosophy or spirituality which has material motivation behind it. So, anyway, it's an interesting juxtaposition of the age of Kali with, you know, the great mercy of the Srimad Bhagavatam that we're receiving. So, in the purport to that second verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first thing that Srila Prabhupada begins to speak about is the purusharthas, the goals of life. Because this is kind of at the crux of it. What is our goal of life? What is it we're interested in? What do we want? And of course, those four purusharthas are needed in human civilization. These are the goals and interests that any civilization or any individual will have. And of course, those are dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Economic development, artha, kama, sense gratification, dharma, religion, and moksha, liberation. And it's described that dharma is the most important for the others, because the others will come about naturally through dharma. Now, that was more prominent, obviously, in past ages, where dharma was very much, you know, was very strong, you know, especially in Satya Yuga, and then progressively deteriorating to the point where you get Kali Yuga, where adharma is mostly prominent. And therefore, we see these things are reversed in Kali Yuga, that arta and kama, economic development and enjoying one's senses are the prominent activity, desires, and behavior and motivation of most people. And then there's a tiny little dharma, yet you go to church on Sunday or whatever for some show. I'm not saying everybody does, but that tends to be the prominent activity in this age of Kali. You know, that things are done, that religion is really more for show. You know, it's like when you think about, you know, Have you ever heard any politician say, basically, I'm an atheist, or I don't believe in religion, or, you know, I go to church with my family, but really it's just a social convention, and I, you know, just for a good show. No, they're never going to say that. You know, that may be the truth. You know, because it's, you know, it still looks good. I suppose as Kali Yuga progresses, people won't even make any attempt. You know, there'll not even be a show of religion. But right now, there's still at least a little bit of adherence to the idea that religion's a good thing. At any rate, these three goals tend to be there, and when those individuals become increasingly frustrated that this really doesn't work out for them very well in the material world, that's not really happening, then moksha, liberation, comes about. I want to get out of here. There must be something beyond this, something beyond materialism. And that grows out of frustration in material life. Now, that's very valued, of course, by jnanis and yogis. We don't see that so much in Kali Yuga. Again, not a lot of interest in moksha. I mean, how many people do you meet and say, you know what my really goal of life is really to get out of this life, to get out of this material world? You don't hear that very often because, you know, we tend to become so covered over that we think this is it. This is the all in all. This is what is important. My goals and motivation should be to enjoy this life and rarely thinking how to get out of this. But there must be something more than this. So anyway, these purusharthas are very important, although Srimad Bhagavatam tells us they're not important. In fact, Sridhar Swami says that these are no more important than a blade of grass. And the result of the chatur purusharthas are automatically achieved through bhakti yoga, so shouldn't even worry about them. That's another topic. Anyway, well, actually, we will go into that topic. There's a nice verse in Adi Lila 7:144. Panchama Purusharta Se Prema Madanahana. Love of Godhead is so exalted, it is considered to be the fifth goal of human life, called Krishna Prema Dana, the treasure of love of God. So the highest goal, the highest motivation is beyond these four, to achieve pure love of God. In a purport to C.C. Anchalila 7:24, Prabhupada says, Purusharta generally refers to religion, economic development, satisfaction of the senses, and finally, liberation. However, above these four Purusharthas, love of Godhead stands supreme. It is called Parama Purusharta, the supreme goal of life, or Purusharta Shiromani, the most exalted of all Purusharthas. Lord Krishna is worshipped by regulative devotional service, but the highest perfection of devotional service is spontaneous love of Godhead. So, this is one way that we can look at this in terms of how our motivations are affected by the different goals of life, by what one's aim is, by what one is trying to achieve. We might also look at this in terms of, besides how our different goal structure changes through the yugas, but also how the Vedas prescribe different paths towards liberation, realization, spiritual understanding. So there are three main processes that are described in the Vedas. There's the karma kanda, which is fruit of activity, jnana karma, jnana kanda, which is the pursuit of knowledge, and upasana kanda, which is worship. And Prabhupada describes there are two types of upasana kanda. One, which is devotional service, worship of Krishna. But more commonly, we find worship of the demigods as another type of upasana kanda. And of course, these things are found throughout the Vedas, throughout the Upanishads. There's basically something for everybody. You know, whatever you want, you can find there. Whatever type of worship, whatever one's motivation is, that can become satisfied through the Vedic literatures. In fact, even the Bhagavad Gita has sections on karma yoga, jnana yoga, santi yoga, right? So these are all described. Krishna wants to give the full picture to Arjuna, you know, and to the rest of us. This is all available. These are different paths. And they're all legitimate in the sense that they're all from Krishna. They're all legitimate paths of religion. But Krishna also makes it very clear which one is best. He says in the last verse of chapter 6, and of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So while all of these other paths are given, Krishna is very clear on the preferred path, on which is the highest, and what he is obviously advising Arjuna to take. So, again, the difference in these different goals, the different purusharthas, and the difference in the yoga practice, why does one pick one, why does one pick the other? That's motivation. That's what one's desires, what one's goals, what one's object of life are based upon. So there's a continuum of motivation, right? The living entities. You know, we may be motivated in so many ways. On one hand, we have, you know, Krishna Prema Dana. We have pure love of God, as we could say, the most exalted motivation, to simply achieve pure love of Krishna, pure devotional service. And then on the other end of the continuum, we have the motivation, which is just abject sense gratification, total self-absorption, you know, just, you know, and we see this as sometimes it's almost demoniac activity. It is demoniac activity. In other words, to, you know, to try to achieve whatever I want, whatever, you know, I desire for myself, regardless of anyone else. In fact, this is described in the divine and demoniac natures of Bhagavad Gita. This is the way the demoniac nature thinks. It's all about oneself. What I can gain, what I can get, and nobody else's interest. What to speak of the interest of God? But to speak of how do I serve and please God, the demoniac person doesn't even care how do I serve, please, or even care about anybody else, any other living entity. You know, so this is the far end. And what we see is most living entities are neither one or the other, but they're somewhere in the middle. Particularly in Kali Yuga, we see this. We see all these different modes of nature. Although ignorance is prominent, we do see mixes of different natures of human beings. And so this erosion of the modes of nature through each yuga is described here, and how that influenced the way that people perform religious activity. So we see that karma yoga obviously is about a desire for enjoyment in this life and next, this worship of the demigods, a desire for elevation to heavenly planets, jnana yoga, desire for liberation. And we see other materialistic religions where there might be other desires to go to heaven, or a desire for liberation, but also just a desire for prestige or for pride. Or even if one is a little bit more in the mode of goodness, the desire to be a good person or to do good things. This is a higher motivation, but it's still materialistic. And this is described extensively in the modes of material nature and some very, very nice purports by Srila Prabhupada, how one can become conditioned even by the mode of goodness. So one has to be very careful that regardless of what mode of nature one is in, you know, this is still a binding force in this material world, and it's not the highest goal. It's not the highest motivation. So in bhakti yoga, it should be untinged with any of these lower goals of karma, jnana, and yoga. It should really be focused on pure love of God and become free from any material motivation. And of course, this is described in Bhagavatam 126, Sivaipung Tsang Paro Dharmo Yato Bhaktir Dhokchuje Ahaitupya Pratiyata Yayatma Supersedity. The supreme occupation or dharma for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So this word ahaituki, the prophet translated here as unmotivated. Anybody remember, like within the word for word, there's another word that Prabhupada uses besides unmotivated. I can't remember, but anyway, it's something similar to that. But it's interesting that Prabhupada chose this to translate here as unmotivated. In other words, there shouldn't be any material motivation, any outside motivation, as well as uninterrupted means that it's continuous, that it's not sometimes I feel like serving, sometimes I don't feel like serving. So this type of devotional service, which is unmotivated and is continuous, will completely satisfy the self. Causeless and unbroken. Causeless. That was the other translation of it. Yeah. In other words, no material cause, no material reason for it. So this is very fundamental to bhakti. And in fact, our most fundamental definition of bhakti, which we find in 1.1.11 of Bhakti Samhita Sindhu, the Anya Balasita Shunya verse, is that it is without desire, bhakti, without desire other than that of the service of Lord Krishna, without material desire. So it's described as continuous devotional service to Krishna, and also jnana karma jnana arpita. It's devoid of karma, jnana, or yoga. So in other words, pure devotional service does not have desire for any of these things, but only for continuous devotional service to Krishna. So, of course, for the neophyte devotee, this is difficult. This is not such an easy thing, to come to this level of unmotivated, you know, and uninterrupted service. This is a very advanced platform of pure devotional service. Therefore, we have the principles given to us by Krishna, by Lord Chaitanya, by our acharyas, of sadhana and vaidhi bhakti, the practice of devotional service. So, in the beginning, we may perform devotional service with other motivations. So maybe there's motivation for sense desire. Maybe there's motivation for recognition, or for some position, or for some prestige. Those things are there. And those things are known. There's even terms for these, the karma mishra bhakti, jnana mishra bhakti. In other words, bhakti, which is mixed. Mishra basically means mixed with other things. It's not pure. So that's something that's no surprise. It's very well known. It's described in our scriptures. It's expected, especially in Kali Yuga. you know, that pure devotee, pure bhakti is going to be mixed with these other desires, with other activities, with other motivation. And therefore, sometimes these other desires are called weeds. They're described in Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila 19.158, it says, sometimes unwanted creepers, such as the creepers of desire for material enjoyment and liberation from the material world, grow along with the creeper of devotional service. The varieties of such unwanted creepers are unlimited. It's kind of scary. These include diplomatic behavior, animal killing, mundane profiteering, mundane adoration, and mundane importance. So these are weeds that come about. And it's described that they grow along with the actual bhakti lata bij, along with the actual creeper devotional service, which is also growing. These weeds will arise. So we have to be very, they're also known as offenses sometimes. So it's very important that these weeds be, you know, cut back. And anyone who has ever done any gardening in Florida can understand this analogy very, very well. Because, you know, especially here, the weeds quickly overtake anything, trust me, that you plant, unless they are tended to in some way. So, we need to be very aware of our own motivation. We need to be aware of what we're doing and why we're doing it. Not that we necessarily are going to come immediately to a pure platform, but at least be aware of these things so that we can work on cultivating the garden of devotional service and ridding ourselves of these weeds. So does this mean that a devotee who has absolutely no motivation, no self-interest? Not exactly. The pure devotee may not have material motivation, but self-interest is always there. In other words, we are the self. There is the soul, and the soul has an interest, and the soul has desire. So what is that? So we don't have material motivation, but there is a spiritual self-interest. In the Bhagavatam 5.6.19, it says, those who unnecessarily engage in bodily conceptions and create an atmosphere of materialism are always ignorant of their real self-interest. Out of his causeless mercy, Lord Rishabhdev taught the self's real identity and goal of life. So there is a goal of life, there is a self-interest, there is the real desire and the real position of the living entity, which of course we should be mindful of, and that we should try to achieve. Prabhupada says in the purport, satisfaction through self-realization is called Swarupananda. The conditioned soul, eternally sleeping in darkness, does not understand his self-interest. He simply tries to become happy by making material adjustments, but this is impossible. It is therefore said in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Nate Vadu Svartagatim Hivishnum, 7.531. Due to gross ignorance, the conditioned soul does not know that his real self-interest is to take shelter of the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. So, if one is intelligent, one understands one's real self-interest. And that real self-interest is to become happy, but to become spiritually happy, to become satisfied, spiritually satisfied. To become free from these material miseries. Nobody wants to be unhappy. Nobody wants to be miserable. Nobody wants to suffer. So in the material world, these things are going to happen. It's inevitable. It's inevitable that there's going to be suffering in this material world, and particularly being in Kali Yuga. We're hearing verse after verse after verse of how difficult it is in this Kali Yuga. There's a predominance of cheating, lying, sloth, sleepiness, violence, depression, lamentation, bewilderment, fear, and poverty. You think we might suffer a little bit here? Things might not go so well? We may be a little bit unhappy, yes. In fact, it's surprising when it does go well. It's surprising when there isn't all of these difficulties due to the age of Kali. So this is the nature of this world, this is how we find ourselves. So the self-interest is obviously to get out of this miserable condition. Our self-interest is not to suffer, but we have to understand how to do it. We have to understand the process. And that process is through devotional service. That process is to know our real self, the pure self, the spirit soul, who is part and parcel of Krishna, eternal servitor of Krishna, in a loving relationship with Krishna, of devotional service. When we understand that, we serve our real self-interest and we become happy. Because the self is in alignment with the super self. The self is in alignment with Krishna. Krishna's interests and our interests become aligned. If we want what God wants, we're in pretty good position, because there's a lot better chance of what God wants happening than what I want, right? So in other words, if I align myself with the desires of Krishna, with the desires of Lord Chaitanya, the desires of Guru, I'm in very good position. I'm in a very good situation. If I am against those desires and I have my own desires which are contrary to Krishna's, then I'm setting myself up for unhappiness. I'm setting myself up for suffering. I'm setting myself up for failure, really. Very hard to succeed successfully in this material world for anybody. It's not so hard to succeed spiritually. It really doesn't require so much. In fact, before all the rules of Vaidhi Bhakti are described, Rupa Goswami simply says, he quotes Padma Purana, always remember Krishna, never forget him. In other words, that's the simple rule. Rupa Goswami says, this is the main rule. Remember Krishna, don't forget him. Now, here's all the other rules that'll help assist that. You know, in other words, you know, we might need a little more direction to just, you know, remember Krishna, don't forget him. So there's a lot of other rules that are there. A lot of things that are activities we do, like chanting Hare Krishna, you know, that help us. And things that we don't do, which would make us forget Krishna, like breaking the four regular principles. So basically, all these other principles are subsidiary and are complementary to the basic principle of always remember Krishna and never forget him. So how do we always remember Krishna, especially at our neophyte stage? I've mentioned this, I'm sure, many times before, but I like to always mention again that Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that satatam always means remember Krishna every day. You're not going to be able to worship, to be able to remember Krishna every moment. Someday, hopefully we will. But as neophyte sadhakas, we probably won't remember Krishna every moment. So he says, at least if we remember every day. And that's what sadhana bhakti is. How to remember Krishna every day. So how do we do that? It's easy. We come and see the deities. How can we not remember Krishna? We chant Hare Krishna on our beads. We're chanting 16 rounds. How many times, how many names of Krishna is that? About 25,000 a day, 26,000? We might, some of those 26,000 names might actually penetrate and we might remember Krishna. It might happen. In fact, there's a real good chance of it happening, and if we don't do it, there's a real good chance it won't happen, right? And of course, we hear Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. We hear, and we hear us particularly, the words of Srila Prabhupada and our guru. If we're hearing about Krishna, if we're hearing about Krishna, we're chanting about Krishna, what comes next? Remember, right? Shravanam Kirtanam Smaranam. Remembering Krishna comes about through hearing and chanting, the process of bhakti yoga, sadhana bhakti. So when we do that, we are actually connecting with the real self-interest of the soul. Self-interest of the soul is kind of, that's redundant actually, because the self is the soul. So the real interest of the soul, and it's pure, is pure devotional service, developing a relationship with Krishna. And so we want to be able to reach the position where chanting Hare Krishna, serving Krishna, becomes its own reward, its own motivation. Our motivation should be to please the Lord through glorifying him, by serving him, and that becomes pleasing to the self. What was that famous Napariyeham, that famous verse in the 10th 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, where Krishna's speaking to the gopis. And he finally, they're lamenting, and he's left them, and he's treated them kind of badly. Of course, it's all spiritual. Krishna's treating them badly. He's increasing the love of gopis by increasing their separation. And finally says to him, I can't repay you. They had such a high level of prema, high level of devotion. He says, I can't repay you. You'll have to be satisfied by your own devotion. And that is satisfying. And that's the point. It's not like they say, oh, well, some excuse, but we're really unsatisfied. No, they were satisfied. They're satisfied in the relationship with Krishna. They're satisfied with their love for Krishna. When we're feeling love for Krishna, we're satisfied. The heart is completely satisfied. So it'll take some time, take some doing, take a little bit of work maybe to get to that point. But fortunately, it begins. Right? It begins from the beginning, of course. But there is that satisfaction, there is that love for Krishna that is experienced to some degree, at least, in the beginning, when we begin chanting and hearing about Krishna and serving Krishna. So Krishna gives us a little taste. He gives us a little satisfaction. Gives us some sort of preview of something that's called, what is it, Parabhakti or shadow? What's the word, chaya? What is it? It's para attachment or chaya attachment. No, it's, anyway, there's this, it's this sort of a hint. Okay. It's sort of like we get a little taste, little pre-taste of what pure devotional service is by the mercy of the Guru. So that's there. And to the degree that we're not completely pure, we might have other motives. We may want to experience personal happiness or satisfaction, whatever. But it should never deter us from Krishna consciousness, because it is a process that is progressive, that continually works more and more. And in fact, the Bhagavatam tells us that whatever motivation we might have, the answer is to serve Krishna. So we have 2, 3, 10. Akama sarvakamova mokshakamo dharati tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. A person who has broader intelligence, whether he be full of all material desires, without any material desires, or desiring liberation, must by all means worship the supreme whole, the personality of Godhead. So the message of the Bhagavatam is, whatever one's motivation is, whatever one's desire is, whatever our goal of life is, fulfill that through worship of Krishna. Fulfill that through remembering Krishna, chanting Krishna's name. And if those desires are materially motivated or tinged, that will become purified. That's the purifying process of bhakti yoga. But it doesn't matter whether the desire is pure. The service itself is pure, and we become purified through the engagement in that service. That's the whole process of bhakti yoga, which Prabhupada tells us over and over again. We can think of so many examples, analogies, the iron rod and the fire, etc., etc. How, one becomes purified through this process. And as one becomes purified, the motivation and desires become purified. Because that's really ultimately the crux here. When our goal and motivation becomes pure, then we're going to act more and more purely. We're going to act more and more for the satisfaction of Krishna and Srila Prabhupada, and less for our personal satisfaction. And of course, it's more difficult now because it's Kali Yuga. Everything becomes difficult. But after we hear the 20 verses of how terrible Kali Yuga is, we end on an up note, right? At the end of this chapter, I think Dravida mentioned it too, and others have mentioned it. That we get this ray of hope, at the last two verses of the chapter. So stay tuned for that. You're all going to want to hear those, but you know what they are. Kali Yuga, we have the Sankirtan movement. And that's our hope, despite this age and all of its difficulties. Okay, thank you so much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Any comments or questions? Ms. Sukuna?
So, you know, we've all heard that prophet said that Krishna never gives you more than you can handle. Mm. In fact, someone asked Prabhupada that question. Prabhupada, is that true that you said that, that Krishna will never give you more than you can handle? Prabhupada said yes, nor less.
So, Prabhupada said yes, what?
He said yes, that's true, nor less. He won't give you more and he won't give you less. So it's kind of like, you know, the razor's edge. But it does seem sometimes, you know, maybe you experienced it in your own life, that the tests seem to be so difficult that it's like hard to understand, you know, it's hard to move on. You know, it's hard to think that everything's gonna be all right or that Krishna has your best interest in mind. It's very hard to do that. So maybe you can give your own personal realization when you've been in situations and how you've managed to work your way through it.
And in the next minute or two, you want me to come up with that? Okay.
I'll give you five.
That's quite a question. It's a wonderful question that I hope I get a justice to. Of course, my understanding is that, yes, we do get tests by Krishna. And just as Prabhupada said, Krishna also gives us the strength to pass those tests along with the tests. And sometimes it may seem very, very difficult to us. And sometimes we don't understand why they're happening. Why are we put into difficulty? Of course, there's a lot of discussion about this. Bhishma Chakravarti Thakura has discussed this pretty extensively. 1088 report is a very, very long, several pages that discuss this very extensively about why devotees are put into suffering. And as far as I can see, there's three or four reasons why devotees are put into suffering. One is, of course, there's simply the reactions to past karma. It's the residue of karmic reactions that are winding down. Probably gives example of the fan. You pull the plug on the fan. It doesn't stop immediately, but there's some winding down period. And so we do may have to, you know, suffer some residual reaction for past activities. A second reason is basically for the purpose of learning, of growth, for our surrendering to Krishna. And we don't always understand those tests. Vishnath gives the example of sometimes the parent gives sweets to the child and he's very happy. And sometimes if the child's sick, he gives them bitter neem juice, you know, some bitter medicine. The child's not very happy with that. May not think the parent is being kind to them, but they do it out of love to cure them of their disease. So Krishna sometimes has to act that way to cure us of our material disease. And sometimes we're handled roughly by his embrace in that process. And, you know, and Krishna works in such a way for us to learn, for us to grow. Nothing is done automatically or mechanically as in ordinary karma. In ordinary karma, you have a reaction, comes about through past activities. But when one devotes one's life to Krishna, then those reactions are given personally and individually by Krishna in such a way they'll be for a benefit. Other reasons that devotees suffer sometimes is Krishna's pastimes, like Haridas Thakur being, you know, whipped in 22 marketplaces. I think those are very instructive. I don't put myself in that category that, you know, somebody's having, oh, it's Krishna's pastime with me. Not so much, you know, but for advanced devotees, that can be the case. And then there's also another factor, which is a whole other subject, is that we sometimes have to suffer because of our offenses, because of the 10 offenses. And Vishwanath points out that there are two offenses, most particularly if by committing that we may have to suffer some reaction. The others clear themselves up through chanting, but through offenses or blasphemy of the devotees, or by sinful activities on the strength of the holy name, we may have to, Krishna may engage us in some suffering as a result of those offenses. How much time do I have? Anyway, that's one of my takes on this. That there's many reasons, but ultimately, it comes down to faith. It comes down to Krishna has somehow or another put me in a situation. Somehow or another, this is will be for my own good. Somehow I will get through this. I will get through this by simply surrendering to Krishna and continuing my faith. I've in my own life, I found sometimes things I didn't understand at the time, then I did understand later, or they made some sense. And I found that there was some real purpose to it, and it actually was beneficial to me. In fact, I think some of the times when I've had the most realization and the most spiritual advancement and growth have really been in times that are really somewhat stressful or anxiety or difficult or, you know, suffering conditions. You know, so sometimes when everything is going really well, we may be going along well, but we may not surrender as much or learn as much as those times when there is more difficulty. Anything? Would you like to add anything?
I had another question, like with offenses. Like here we are, so many of us, you know, we're worshiping Tulsi every day, and it's supposed to even free you from the reaction of killing a brahmana. So how does that work? You know, I mean, are we freed from the offenses or not necessarily?
Well, that's one of the real mysteries, isn't it? I mean, how are we free, you know, worshiping Tulsi, how are we freed from the reactions of killing a brahmana? Well, my understanding is we do many things in devotional service that give us immediate relief from sinful reactions. In fact, that's one of the first qualities of devotional service, isn't it? Immediate relief from sinful reaction, you know, kleshagni. So that's there. However, the unfortunate problem is we usually start immediately accumulating, you know, them again, or immediately afterwards. So at that moment, we might be completely pure and free from those things, but because of so much past, you know, anartas and all the past stuff, we tend to resume materialistic activities, behaviors, thoughts, and therefore we probably somewhat nullify that moment of pure devotional service. I don't know if there's a better explanation than that. Maybe. Anybody have any thoughts on that one? Yeah, right?
Thank you for your class. I was thinking this question. So how does Krishna know our thoughts before we think them? So I was first I was going to ask a few people. Then I said, okay, maybe I'll put it in a database and see what Prabhupada said about that. But it seems like during your class you covered quite a bit. But one thing I thought was very important that you said was about faith. You know, because if we keep faith in the devotional process, then we can weather the storms that come. But one thing I had a little difference in what you said when you were saying that it's easy to succeed in the material world.
They say it was easy to succeed in material?
No. I made a note of this. You said it was. No, you said it was easy to be to succeed in the spiritual paradigm, but it's difficult in the material world.
Right.
Yeah. So I was running it through my mind, and I was thinking majority of people who succeed in the material world are cheaters nowadays. You know, there's a lot of honest people out there too. I don't think they.
I'm sorry. Say it again.
There are quite a few of the prominent people nowadays that are materially, so-called materially successful, are cheaters, and in leadership positions. And people think that this is the only way that I can succeed is by cheating.
But they don't succeed at the time of death, do they?
Right.
Birth, death, disease, and old age are there for everybody.
Right. I was listening to a lecture from Radha Swami the other day, and he was saying that time is all devouring time.
Yeah, time is there for everyone.
That's right.
You know, I think it was my last class, I just mentioned that story of Ambarish told about his meeting with Prabhupada, right? You know, when Prabhupada said, so Henry Ford is your grandfather? And he says, yes. He said, so where is Henry Ford now? In other words, very, very, you know, most successful person, but where is he now? What is his destination? Yeah. So, yeah, material life is generally not successful, you'd say. Ultimately not successful. Although it may appear, you know, by someone's karma.
I thought of the verse Narada Muni told to Vyasadeva about that the material miseries are superfluous to living entity, and they can directly be mitigated by the process of bhakti yoga. So I was thinking sometimes, I don't know if it's a speculation or not, but our identity changes, that we don't identify with the body, so there's some detachment from the external conditions that are taking place.
Oh, of course.
But I also had a question. You were talking about the prema pumartha mahan, the fifth goal of life, that's prema. And since Krishna, it says the intelligent design, that this universe, they're starting to notice that it's got some intelligence behind it. And if that's his goal, would that be all-pervadingly integrated, intrinsically integrated into everything, because that's what the goal is. So when it was created so everything actually functions in that capacity also.
Sure. Oh. Sounds good to me. That would take some more time and discussion, but yeah, sounds good. Okay, last comment.
I was thinking that in Harishwari Prabhu's diary that he writes about Srila Prabhupada's toothache in Australia. The doctor, the dentist says it is so severe pain he should not speak at all for 3 days.
Say about pain, what? Yeah.
The pain from the toothache.
Toothache, okay.
It's so severe that he should not be allowed to speak to anyone for 3 days.
The dentist told him he shouldn't speak because of his toothache. Yeah.
Right. But then in the afternoon when no visitor came, Prabhupada said, my suffering is that I cannot speak about Krishna, not the toothache. So then question came whether did he feel the pain that dentist actually experienced from their knowledge and their own personal experience that it is actually severe pain. But Prabhupada says no. He actually feel pain when he cannot speak about Krishna. So it's very interesting that how you, in your explanation of different suffering, that what I heard from you just now, that some conditioned soul suffers due to ignorance. Most all the conditioned souls suffer due to ignorance. And some devotee suffers due to offensive nature. But then there is apparently another suffering. I said apparently because it's Krishna's will. There's a purpose Krishna has. Like Prabhupada said, for Jarabharat, from a high-class human birth to a dear body, Prabhupada said this is not a karmic reaction, it's a divine arrangement of the Lord. So it's not a suffering in a sense, because in the form of a dear body, his intensity to serve is much more than when he had a human body. So it's actually further progression.
So this would be an example of how an apparent suffering for a devotee was beneficial.
Yeah, it is not really suffering because he was not acting as a deer. He was constantly meditating that as soon he takes a human body, he will not do anything but think of Krishna. So it was a further progression. It was very nice in that sense.
Good. Okay. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.